we've been interrupted because I got sick and then we took a trip and we've sort of been 2 weeks on, a week off, a week on, a week off again. And so we got a nice run of weeks here going up to the end of 2021 that we should be able to consistently continue to add lessons in this series. If you're joining us, thanks, Will. If you're joining us online this morning, if you're on YouTube, you can click in the description under the video. You'll find a link to the notes. If you're joining us on Facebook and you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, there's an entry right here for October 31st, lesson 154. If you click on that, it will allow you to open up the notes. And these are the notes that we are going to be going over here in class in person. So feel free to do that and follow along as we move through things, okay? So I have 9 pages here. We need to get rolling quick. I don't know if we're going to make it through all 9. We'll get as far as we can, and then I'll decide what to do as we get up to the end. So the Hampton Court Conference, lesson 154. Whoops, didn't want to do that. Lesson 154, the Hampton Court Conference, historical significance, dates, and accounts. Introduction. 2 weeks ago in lesson 153, we considered the millenary petition and its connection with the Hampton Court Conference of 1604. We want to ascertain what transpired at Hampton Court and how it impacted the English Bible. Understanding some of the historical background for the meeting will assist us with this task. So in this lesson, we're going to consider the following regarding this important meeting. I want to first talk about the historical significance of Hampton Court. That's point number one. Point number two, I want to talk about the dates, the date of the meeting, because there's some things we need to note about that. And then I want to talk about accounts, the surviving accounts of the meeting that have come down to us through history. I want to spend some time talking about that as well. So those are kind of the 3 points that we're going to be looking at. So let's get right into the first point, then, Hampton Court historical significance. Many historians believe that Hampton Court was a pivotal meeting for reasons beyond the decision to create the King James Bible. The outcomes of this meeting potentially sowed the seeds of the English Civil War, as well as spurred the English colonization of the New World. So I hinted at this 2 weeks ago when we talked, that there are some significant historical ramifications that come out of this meeting beyond just the decision to translate the King James Bible. Once again, Timothy Berg does an excellent job covering these matters in 3 entries on the Hampton Court Conference on his blog, King James Bible History. In his entry from December 2nd, 2020, titled Hampton Court, Avenue and Dates, Brother Berg states the following, quote, "The Hampton Court Conference of 1604 was described by Frederick Shriver as, quote, one of the most significant events in the political and religious history of England. It set the course for the future of the Church of England and determined the role the Puritans would, or rather would not, play in the official church. Some have perceived the seeds of the English Civil War, now more commonly called the War of the Three Kingdoms, being planted at this conference. Indeed, given the colonization of the New World by the Puritans, as they increasingly found less room for them in the English church, one could even say that this conference shaped the future of religion and politics in North America. In terms of both religion and politics, it is thus an event of historical importance worth exploring." So what Berg's saying there is, as we've already kind of alluded to last time we met 2 weeks ago, the Puritans are going to be largely shut down at this meeting as far as what they want. They outlined their grievances in the millenary petition. They submitted to the king. The conference is held, as we're just getting into discussing the conference now. And they're basically not going to get too much of what they asked for. And so as a result, there's going to be the seeds of American colonization planted here, the seeds of the English Civil War. A lot of things are going to transpire and have an impetus in the Hampton Court Conference. Let's go on with the quote. "We have traced already the discontent with the Elizabethan settlement," and we did that, see lesson 51, "that found new life breathed into it at the coming of King James VI of Scotland to the English throne. Some were content with the way religion had settled under Elizabeth. Others, primarily the Puritans, were convinced that the English church, which retained so much ceremony from the traditional church, was, quote, but halfway reformed. They were deeply troubled and discontented with the state of affairs." As we have looked in depth at the millenary petition, see lesson 153, which was the prime expression of such discontent, and at some of the specific requests which it made of the new king. The king eventually arranged the Hampton Court Conference to deal with the issues these Puritans kept raising and complaining about, or, more accurately, to deal with the pesky Puritans who were always raising them. Our primary interest is, of course, more narrowly on the history of the King James Bible itself, yet it was at this conference that the King James Bible was first conceived, and because the politics of the conference heavily shaped the end product, the conference is worth looking at in some detail in its own right. Now let's just stop there. So, I told you 2 weeks ago that there's no mention of a new Bible in the millenary petition. There is no mention of a new Bible as a point the Puritans were interested in the documents they submitted to the king before Hampton Court. Yet it's at Hampton Court that the idea is first conceived for there to be a new translation of the Bible into English, as we'll see when we unfold. So for the sake of time and space, we will pass over Berg's fascinating comments regarding architecture, should say the architecture, and physical layout of the palace at Hampton Court. Interested parties are encouraged to read this information, as it is interesting to consider those beyond the scope of the scope of our focus in this lesson. You can leave it the way it is. So the first point is to just recognize that there's a lot of significance in what's happening at this meeting. Our primary concern is the fact that this is where the King James Bible is first originated, but there's also wider-ranging political and historical implications for what happened at Hampton Court. So let's move then straight into the dates. Hampton Court dates. Originally planned for November 1603, the conference was delayed by an outbreak of plague. The meeting was moved out of London to Hampton Court and set for mid-January 1604. On October 24, 1603, James issued a proclamation announcing the change of date and venue, titled "Concerning such as seditiously seek reformation in church matters." James's proclamation is very telling in terms of his opinion of the Puritan case. Let's stop there. What does he call? He issues a proclamation. What is the name of the proclamation? The name of the proclamation is concerning such as seditiously seek reformation in church matters. Folks, what is James's view of these Puritans? He views them as what? Seditious. How do I know? That's what he titled the proclamation. So before they even have the meeting, what is James's attitude and opinion about these Puritans? He views them as a bunch of seditious guys.
So does that mean they want to overthrow the...
That means he views them as a threat to his authority at a minimum. At a minimum, that's what that means. In his blog post, Berg mentions that a certain level of confusion exists as to the actual start for the rescheduled conference in January. And I was alluding to this last time, and you'll see that hopefully here in a moment. It seems that the conference, we need quotation marks at the beginning of that indentation there, Sylvia. It seems that the conference was first rescheduled for Thursday, the 12th of January, 1604. But given that it was a hectic time of attending to visiting dignitaries, at the last minute, the plans were changed again, and it was rescheduled for Saturday, the 14th of January. While rumors of the latest change spread as late as the night of the 11th, the bishops apparently were not sure how true they were, so they showed up on the morning of the 12th, ready to start the conference as originally planned. Okay? So, the original date said that this thing was supposed to start when? On the 12th. And then there was apparently some delay because certain people couldn't make it, and so they bumped the meeting to when? The 14th. But on the 12th, who shows up anyway? The bishops of the Anglican Church show up anyway on the original date the thing was scheduled for on the 12th. Okay, let's go on. The bishops apparently were not sure how true they were, so that referring to these rumors of the date change. So they showed up on the morning of the 12th ready to start the conference as originally planned. Now look it, this resulted in what we could call an unplanned pre-conference meeting between just the king and the bishops that Thursday. So do the bishops end up with a private audience with King James on the 12th of January? Now what do you think they talked about? Now we don't know for sure. There's no historical documents that I know of that have survived history that would record the contents of it, but I think we can make some pretty educated speculations about what they might have talked about, right? What did James call the meeting? He called it the meeting to hear the seditious guys. I'm paraphrasing, right? And now he's got the bishops alone in an unplanned pre-meeting, and they meet anyway. What do you think they talked about in that meeting? To me, one of the things is they had to have talked about what was going to go on the rest of the meeting, including what the Puritan grievances probably would have been in the millenary petition and in any documentation they would have submitted before the meeting. So when I said 2 weeks ago that James was definitely slanted a certain way in this, there's absolutely no doubt, right? James isn't like, whoa, 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 time out. You guys are here too early. It's not fair for me to meet with you privately before the meeting starts and the Puritans aren't here. That's not what he did. What did he do? He went ahead with this meeting anyway. And we already saw in the proclamation to have the meeting that he calls the Puritans seditious. All right? Next paragraph. In fact, because some who write on the conference today don't always canvass the whole range of sources, more on those sources in coming posts, confusion about the dating still exists, made worse by the common confusions about the old and new style dating and when to begin the new year. For example, Truly, he's one author, page 108, mistakenly dates the first pre-conference to 10 January, while Gerald Gray, on page 820, in a footnote, following only the account of Patrick Galloway, who includes the pre-conference meeting and thus dates the conference from the 12th through the 18th, states mistakenly that the 3 days of the conference were the 12th, the 16th, and the 18th. In reality, the dates, as they ended up working out, were as follows. Tuesday, 1st of November, 1603. You can put this up here for anyone who's watching. So we're at the top page 3. So Tuesday, 1st of November, 1603, that was the original scheduled date for the thing to start. But it was canceled because of that outbreak of plague. Okay? Then Thursday, the 12th of January, 1604, was the pre-conference unscheduled meeting between the bishops and the king. Then Saturday, the 14th of January, was the first official day of the conference. And Monday, the 16th of January, was the second day of the conference. And then they met again on Wednesday, the 18th of January, 1604, was the third and final day of the conference in two parts, according to Berg's research. Okay? So, there's a couple of things that seem pretty clear. We know for a fact that the first meeting was canceled. It's very clear now from some more digging that Berg has done that there was an unplanned pre-conference on the 12th, which was the day the original thing was supposed to be, but then it got bumped, and then once the meeting started on the 14th officially, then they kind of went every other day with the meeting until the thing was done on Wednesday, the 18th of January. So, what's important to take from this point is again the fact that it really gives away James's attitude towards these Puritans, right? He's willing to meet privately with the bishops and not have the Puritans be there at all on the 12th of January, 1604. So James is not very favorable, as we can gather now, towards the Puritans and their requests. Is everybody with me? I know there's a lot of stuff to track with here, but hopefully you're able to follow what I'm saying. So let's move on then to our third point today, which is the different accounts of Hampton Court. Again, following Berg, this time from his December 9, 2020 blog post titled Hampton Court Attendees, we can observe the following quote. The Hampton Court Conference in 1604 not only set the direction for the Church of England's future, it also was the context in which the King James Bible was first conceived. At least the mature form of it later came to fruition. To fully grasp the import of the conference and its impact on the King James Bible, we must also say what we can about who attended. Many men would work on the King James Bible, and we will specifically note which of these men were present at this moment in its prehistory. Yet this requires first saying something briefly about the contemporary sources that are extant. So, what he's saying there is that there are a handful of men who are ultimately going to work on the King James Bible translation project who are in attendance at Hampton Court. And some of them were Puritans, and some of them were also Anglican bishops. So there's a lot of the men, not all of them, a handful, I should probably say more accurately, maybe a couple handfuls of them, that were present at the Hampton Court meeting when the decision was made to make a new translation. So, there are two major accounts of what happened at Hampton Court in January 1604. Burke states the following regarding the matter, quote, "The two major sources for the Hampton Court Conference, sometimes at odds, are first, the semi-official count which William Barlow was asked to write up, a participant in the conference, and later head of the Second Westminster Company of the Translators for the King James Bible." So, the first document we have is this one right here. The sum and substance of the conference. And this is written by Barlow. You can see his name right here. And Barlow is the one who writes the semi-official record of the meeting. You can see that this thing was first published based on his notes, or at least this particular printing of it was published in 1638. Okay? Now, I have this document in my digital library, and I've read it some and looked at it quite a bit as we prepared for this. But the first surviving account of the meeting is Barlow's. All right? Let's go back. In his Sum and Substance of the Conference, which is this book right here, it's on the screen behind me. In his Sum and Substance of the Conference, he takes a decidedly more positive view of the bishops and presents the king as supportive of episcopacy and dismissive of the Puritans. Second is an anonymous account printed in Usher, sometimes called the
Harleian
account. Now, we can look at that. I believe I have the link, so let's try and look at that. It's on page 3, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, if we click that, we should be able to load it, assuming we don't encounter any trouble here, okay? So the other account is in this book right here, the Reconstruction of the English Church, and here you can see the Harleian manuscript is listed here. So these are the two primary accounts of what happened at Hampton Court. One, the author of this is anonymous. The document does not have a name on it as far as the author is concerned. And it is the competitive account to Barlow's The Sum and Substance. All right, so I have access to both of them. I won't say I've read every line and every word, but I've read a lot of what I thought were the most pertinent parts. Okay. So this Harleian account, which represents a more positive account of the Puritans. So here's the thing. Barlow is more pro-episcopacy, pro-bishops, and more negative towards the Puritans, and the Harleian account is more positive toward the Puritans and more negative towards who? The bishops. So what that probably tells you is the difference of point of view from the author. Barlow was more favorable towards the high Anglican Church in his account, and whoever authored Harleian account is probably more positive toward the Puritans. Okay. So, back to the notes, bottom of page 3, which present a more positive account of the Puritans, presents James as largely supportive of them and takes a quite dim view of the bishops. So we have two opposing accounts. There are also more than a dozen additional commentary accounts that contribute to our picture of the conference. Because such data will likely interest only the super nerds, I guess that's me, we have placed it in a separate post here, which most readers can safely ignore. For reasons detailed in that post on sources, and contrary to Nicholson, Curtis, and some others, we take Barlow as a largely faithful account that has been vindicated and follow his narrative in this in the next few posts, supplementing it where needed with other sources. So, there's some debate in the scholarly literature about the Hampton Court Conference about whose account is more accurate. Is the Barlow account, which is pro-episcopacy, pro-bishops, and more negative towards the Puritans, the more accurate picture? Or is the Harleen account that I showed you a minute ago, the one that is more pro-Puritan and more negative towards the Anglican bishops, which account is the more accurate account? It seems, as a result of the research, that the Barlow account definitely seems to be the more faithful representation. So, since the mid-17th century, the account of Barlow found in the Sum and Substance has been taken to be a reliable record of what transpired at the conference. And again, that's that document right there. Quote, the longest and most well-known account of the conference is the semi-official, the Sum and Substance of the conference, by Dean of Chester, William Barlow, regular spokesman for and defender of episcopacy. That's a high word for the established church order, okay? The Anglican Church. He would go on to serve as a translator for the King James Bible as the head of the Second Westminster Company, which worked on the King James Bible epistles, Romans through Jude. So this guy Barlow, he's a translator, and he ends up being a translator, and he works on the section that was assigned to work on Romans through Jude. Okay? That's later. C.S. Knighton summarized page 2, Barlow's attendance at the conference and writing of the account, explaining that, quote, by 8 May, Barlow had been chosen Dean of Chester, which he was installed on 12 June, yet this office, perhaps reflecting his origins in the Northwest, had little claim on his attention. Its chief importance was that it gave him status to attend Hampton Court Conference of 14 through 18 January 1604. Barlow was commissioned to write the official account of these proceedings in which the hierarchy confronted its Puritan critics with the king in the chair. Publication was delayed by Whitgift's death, 29 February. On 12 May, Barlow invited Cecil to accept the declaration, but the latter prudently asked to see the text first and then avoided Barlow until the book had gone to press. Bancroft, the king's secretary, Sir Thomas Lake, and the king himself allegedly approved Barlow's draft, which appeared on 25 May as the Sum and Substance of the Conference, 1604. So this particular one I have here is a 1638 edition. This originally appeared in May of 1604, about 5 months, give or take, after the meeting. Okay. However, as it came off the press, it was immediately criticized for misrepresentation, in particular, for making the king's side comprehensively with the bishops. This wasn't news to Barlow. Knighton continues, quote, he had foreseen controversy, offering as a disclaimer that he was only giving the substance of the conference and not always recording verbatim everything said. In fact, he published as an appendix 4 different Puritan slanted accounts, representatives of what he claimed to be a current basis in the opposite direction. So, when this is first published, is Barlow anticipating some people are going to criticize him? So he took some steps pre-publication to have it looked at. Cecil avoided the whole thing altogether, and apparently the king and Bancroft, who we'll talk a lot more about in a future lesson, they said that it was okay. But it does come off the press originally with some disagreement about what happened. Shortly, the skepticism about Barlow's accuracy was overcome as his account came to be almost universally trusted by standard historians. Fuller noted in his 1655 history, quote, others complain that this conference is partially set forth only by Dr. Barlow, Dean of Chester, their professed adversary, to the great disadvantage of their divines, yet used it as the basis for his own recasting of the conference in the form of a dialogue. Strype, in 1718, did likewise, suggesting that it was an authentic relation written by Barlow that was very truth of the conference, that the very truth of the conference may appear. Cardwell, in 1640, used Barlow as one of the main foundations of his treatment of the conference. Later in the century and after its turn, classic treatments of the conference, like those by the eminent English historian S.R. Gardiner in 1883 and Roland Green Usher in 1910, relied almost exclusively on Barlow's account, revealing that while different interpretations of the conference had emerged, Barlow's account had come to be accepted as largely historically accurate picture, but would this trust last? So that's all long-winded way of saying that this originally had some criticism. By the middle of the 1600s was his accepted as the standard view of what happened at the conference. And was it that way for basically the rest of the 1600s, all of the 1700s, all of the 1800s, and into the early 1900s, did people view this as the principal account of what happened at Hampton Court in 1604? Now, the middle of the 20th century, in the 1960s, a scholar is going to come forward and say that this isn't as accurate as people think it is. And that's what we're going to talk about next. Trust in Barlow's account went virtually unchallenged for three centuries until the 1961 publication of Hampton Court Conference and its aftermath by Mark H. Curtis. Once again, we turn to Berg's excellent work for a summary of the situation. Quote, Mark Curtis raised again the question in 1961, how reliable is Barlow's account? He concluded that it was little more than a skillful piece of party propaganda. So what's this guy saying in 1961? He's saying that is what?
Propaganda.
Propaganda. It's propaganda written by the established church to defend their side of what happened at Hampton Court. That's what this historian is saying in 1961, right? He thus gave new prominence to the previously neglected anonymous account that had been printed in Usher, Harley, Manuscript 828, which again is this one right here. So what he's going to do in 1961 is he's going to say, this document here suggests that this document by Barlow is a partisan party document that isn't accurate because it's just written to substantiate the claims of who? The Anglican bishops as a result of what happened at Hampton Court. So he is going to challenge this in 1961. Judging it, the best guide through this whole body of material, which is at all important points consistent with the rest of the evidence. He was influential, and his conclusions were widely followed. Adam Nicholson, echoing Curtis without citing him, suggests that Barlow was, quote, the official propagandist for the bishop's cause, and his pamphlet was carefully slanted version of events. And even went so far as to claim boldly that, quote, that Barlow was lying. Knighton represents this renewed distrust for Barlow's account as well. The extent to which Barlow's summary does indeed convey the substance remains central to the historiography of the conference. His report was long accepted as authentic, though differing interpretations were drawn from it. It has since been shown that he shaped his account for dramatic as well as polemic purpose. It is Barlow who gives James his famous line, no bishop, no king, who had him riled by the advocacy of Presbyterianism during the second day's session at a close with words, I shall make them conform themselves, or I will harry them out of the land, or else do worse. Now let's stop right there. So understand what's going on. Barlow says that James said this stuff about the Puritans. I'm going to make them conform, or I'm going to do what? I'm going to get them out of here. These more modern, these 20th century historians now are saying that this is all, that James never said this stuff, that this is all party propaganda on the part of the Puritans in Barlow's account. Okay, so there's a reason why we should be concerned about this and whether or not we have an accurate understanding of what happened. Other testimony confirms that while the king made a spirited report, he did not end the day on this bitter note. To an extent, the truthfulness of Barlow's version is of less consequence than the impact that it made. This lent powerful support to the view that the Stuart monarchy and the Puritans were from this moment destined to collide. Yet this distrust in Barlow, prompted by Curtis, may turn out to have been short-lived. In 1981, Frederick Shriver pushed back against Curtis, suggested that the anonymous account cannot take the place of the sum and substance. It is far too short and far too thin. It is useful, even important, but supplementary only. Hill pointed out that historically it has always been common to report the events of the conference with a certain bias. Patrick Cullison, in his earlier statements of the conference, here and there, so those were links in what Berg originally said, seemed largely to accept the judgment of Curtis, asserting that the sum and substance was likely a skillfully
tendentious
piece of party propaganda and a journalistic coup that was not as much an exercise in fair and objective reporting as a skillful piece of party propaganda. Yet in his most mature reflection on the conference before his passing, after the developments we will trace below, he came to the slightly more nuanced conclusion that, quote, the various accounts of the conference are all episodic and biased in one way or another, and all must be read with care. So, understand what's going on here. I know I don't want you to be too bored here, okay? I know some of you are like, yeah, this is great, what are we doing here? You got to understand what's going on. If we're going to understand what happened back here when the decision to translate the King James Bible was made, you have to understand, are you entering into a very hotly contested political situation? So the reports of the conference now that have survived seem to be very biased to one side or the other. Now, we don't know anything about that today, do we? There's no political bias and things going on in our day, is there? I mean, this is completely unheard of. I'm being sarcastic, of course. The chief concern in assessing the validity of Barlow's account centers around the following. Did the Puritans receive a fair and impartial hearing at Hampton Court, or was the king firmly anti-Puritan as Barlow seems to suggest? Timothy Berg believes that two lines of evidence vindicate Barlow's account of the Hampton Court proceedings as factually accurate, though somewhat biased. These lines of evidence include, number one, Lawrence Chatterton's copy of the Sum and Substance, and number two, the thesis of William Craig. So let's talk about Lawrence Chatterton's copy of the Sum and Substance first. Regarding this line of evidence, Berg states the following. First, the recently discovered papers of Lawrence Chatterton contain, among other things, his personal annotated copy of Barlow's account. So understand what that is. That's this guy's copy of this book with his personal notes where?
In the margin.
So this Chatterton guy, he had Barlow's book, he read it, and when he read it, he made marginal notes about what Barlow said. You following that?
Mm-hmm.
Arnold Hunt examined this document here, and there's a quote or a link. Chatterton was not only present at the conference on the important second day, he was also, as we noted in our last post, one of the leading spokesmen for the Puritans. So this guy's important. Why is he important? Because he was there, and did he make handwritten notes about what Barlow said in Sum and Substance? And was he in the party that opposed Barlow? You following this? Okay. Whether he himself should be referred to as one is a debated point. So that's just a statement about how Puritan Chatterton actually was. Okay. He went on to be one of the notable King James translators in the first Hebrew company at Cambridge, which worked on 1 Chronicles through Song of Songs. He was educated at Christ College, Cambridge, and was probably still a Catholic when he came, though he quietly converted to Cambridge Protestantism. While a highly respected trilingual biblical scholar and theologian, he was perhaps most well known as a preacher and evangelist. When he gave up his weekly lecture in the pulpit of St. Clement's Church in Bridge Street, which he had held for half a century, 40 divines signed a testimonial to the effect that they owed their conversion to his teaching. Okay? So this Chatterton guy, he's a scholar, he's a linguist, he's a preacher, he's an evangelist, right? And he's at the meeting, he's got his own copy of Barlow, and he's written handwritten notes in the margin. And he's on the opposing side of it. Few could have more reason to see things differently from Barlow, and perhaps more importantly, to contradict him in his annotations when given the chance. Indeed, among the numerous annotations he made in his copy, there are a few that reveal his own memory clashing with Barlow's printed report. Perhaps most importantly is in how the Puritan spokesmen were described. Well, that kind of makes sense if he's one of the Puritan spokesmen. We noted in our last post some diverse views in characterizing these four men. Barlow had described them as, quote, agents of the millenary plaintiffs. Yet at this point in his account, Chatterton took issue with this description, commenting in the margin, quote, patience rather, being commanded to attend, nor but to hear and obey, written and crossed out. So he originally had obey, crossed it out and said hear, His Majesty's pleasure. God forbid we should be agents for any sect in religion or in any faction. Neither could we be for these, seeing none ever required this at our hands. No learning therefore can justify this, nor excuse the breach of charity. So does Chatterton take exception about them being millenary plaintiffs? Okay, let's go on to page 7. We're going to make it through 9 pages, guys. Okay, it's because I talk so fast. For Chatterton, rather than agents, they were patients. In the older sense of the word, meaning a person who or thing which undergoes some action or to which something is done, a passive recipient, chiefly in contrast with agent. So that's an old definition of the word patient. Most of the time you hear the word patient today and you think of, you know, you're the patient and you go see who? The doctor, right? This is an old definition of patient, meaning he views things as being done to them by the king and his company, rather than them being active what?
Agents.
Participants in it. Okay? When Barlow later wrote, the most grave, learned, and modest of the aggrieved sort, the Puritans, were summoned by the king to the conference, Chatterton, as Hunt notes, pounced on the contradiction, arguing in the margin, being sent, for how could they be agents for others, being willed to speak, how could they be plaintiffs? As Hunt points out, Barlow's choice of vocabulary was clearly designed to serve a polemical purpose, but Chatterton's efforts to disassociate himself from the Puritan radicals were equally disingenuous. So, let's follow what's going on. Chatterton is taking exception to certain things Barlow said, right? He views Barlow's comments in some spots as being way too hard on who? The Puritans, right? Chatterton being a Puritan, does he sort of argue the opposite extreme in the margin? Okay. Some have emphasized this disagreement by Chatterton, like Collison, who notes that Chatterton's annotations show that he took strong exception with Barlow's account. Yet for most, what is ultimately striking is, now watch, is how little he contradicts the historical scheme of Barlow. So is Chatterton taking exception with Barlow's notes on what actually happened? The order of the events and what occurred? Or is he taking exception with how he's characterizing the Puritans? The latter, not the former, right? So he's not saying Barlow blew the whole thing up, he got the whole thing wrong, this didn't happen, that didn't happen, he's making this and that up. That's not what he's doing. He seems to have accepted it as accurate except for a few minor points. Hunt noted, quote, there is no doubt that Hampton Court was a fairly comprehensive defeat for the Puritan cause, and qualified that, admittedly, Barlow's narrative may exaggerate the scale of that defeat, but concluded that ultimately what Chatterton says here is arguably less significant than what he fails to say elsewhere. The most crucial events of the conference, quote, attracted no marginal comment from Chatterton, and his annotated copy thus implies that at crucial points, Barlow's account is a totally accurate record of what actually what? Took place. You following that? David Norton, one of the world's leading scholars today on the King James Bible, and I will say, yes, he is. I have four books by Norton. I've emailed exchange with him personally at least three times on things related to this topic. He sent me a lot of stuff, by the way, that I'll show you in some future lessons. Fascinating stuff that he sent me. David Norton is one of the world's leading scholars today on the King James Bible. In his early work, seemingly concurrent with Curtis, cautioning that the accuracy of Barlow's report is questionable. It was written at Bishop Bancroft's request, read by the king before publication, and scorned by those who were not of the church party. Yet in his most recent work, he seems to have been persuaded to a slightly different view by the evidence of Chatterton's copy, noting that, quote, Chatterton, who was present at the conference, noted some vehement disagreements with Barlow's designation of himself, Reynolds, and two other Puritans as, quote, agents of the millenary plaintiffs in his copy of the Sum and Substance, but his silence on the discussion of a new translation suggests that there is nothing significantly wrong with it. So, in its principal things, based upon the annotated copy of Chatterton, can we say that Barlow was telling the truth on the basic facts of what happened at Hampton Court? You guys with me? Okay? And then the last piece of evidence is the thesis of William Craig. Now look, guys, I'm going to stop here just for 1 minute and make an editorial comment. It would have been very easy for me to just say, Millenary Petition, Hampton Court, King James Bible. Okay? And that's the way it has always been presented to me. In all the books I've read and all the lessons I've sat through, the teachings I've heard, it's always been done. And what I'm saying to you is, no. To really understand it, you have to look at the details. So I'm not doing this to just, you know, test your patience. I'm doing this because when we're done, I want to have a much more definitive exposition of what actually what took place. Because I think there are a lot of misconceptions and misunderstandings about this because of the lack of clarity on what's going on and what happened. So the thesis of William Craig. Let me get through this last point and then we'll take any questions or comments before we go. The second line of evidence for the veracity of Barlow's account is presented as follows by Burke, quote, the second development in the thesis is the thesis of William Craig, noted in our last post, which examines each of the extant accounts of the conference. It is likely the most exhaustive examination of the sources to date, and it seeks to vindicate Barlow at length. Though a historical critical analysis of the documents, Craig argues that Barlow's account is a well-sourced eyewitness account, largely accurate, though not completely without bias, and most importantly, corroborated by multiple outside sources at numerous decisive points. Now, this is what you would want. What you would want to do is take all the documents, lay them out on the table, read all of them, and corroborate them based upon what you think is the main account, look for similarities, look for differences, and then decide based upon a comprehensive sweep of the evidence. Okay? So, top page 8, we're starting mid-sentence. So Craig argues that Barlow's account is a well-sourced eyewitness account, largely accurate, though not completely without bias, and most importantly, corroborated by multiple outside sources at numerous decisive points. On the other hand, most of the accounts that agree with the anonymous account in Usher, which have been championed against Barlow, can be traced back to that account itself as a single source. And an anonymous one of doubtful provenance at that. So, what does that mean? That's all fancy history talk for the fact that this alternative account right here only can be traced back to a single source, only one guy's, and an anonymous one, nobody knows who wrote it, and number two, there's no known provenance of where it came from. You following that? Okay. So where are we at here? Usher, have been championed against Barlow can be traced back to that account itself, a single source, an anonymous one of doubtful provenance at that. The anonymous account itself, upon close inspection, quote, shows many signs of being not an eyewitness, but a composite of earlier accounts of the conference. So what would that mean? That mean that whoever wrote this sat down with other things and then did what?
Made a summary.
Clip note, yeah, whatever you want to call it. He thus concludes that Barlow's sum and substance is not only indispensable because it is the longest and most detailed source we have, but also because it seems quite accurately to convey the substance of the conference. In the official Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. That's what ODNB stands for. Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. Entry, Kenneth Fincham concurs, though apparently ignorant of Craig's thesis, suggesting that although Barlow's account is relentlessly deferential to the king and spiky towards the Puritans, it is the indispensable foundation text, three times the length of the anonymous account, and broadly reliable to judge from Lawrence Chatterton's annotated copy, in which he accepts large parts of Barlow's narrative. It would seem that, contrary to the claims of Nicholson, Barlow was not the one lying. The judgment of the editor of an 1804 reprinting of Barlow's account is found to be relevant again in striking ways. Quote, with respect to ourselves, when we consider that Bishop Barlow's account, this famous conference is admitted by all parties to be the only one set forth, and is accordingly by all parties continually quoted, that it was set forth not upon his authority alone, but with the assistance and allowance of several of the great men then present, that no objections to the authenticity of this account of any consequence were brought forward for a considerable time after it took place, and that the best of those objections were weakly and suspiciously urged and never proved, without hesitation we offer this tract to the notice of the public as well deserving attention. It has passed the ordeal of its enemies' utmost malice, and is found to be a true and faithful work. So there's some slight updating of the language there. So, in the final so in other words, are we on good ground, then, good historical ground, for accepting the sum and substance as a largely reliable account of what happened at Hampton Court? In the final section of his post, Berg reports the total number of contemporary accounts of the Hampton Court Conference, according to Craig's reckoning, is 17. These accounts comprise short summaries and letters or diaries, 9 of which come from participants or attendees of the conference, the rest of which are anonymous. Of the 16 accounts, so I have to check that. I don't know why. I think that's a typo. It should say 17. But I need to check that. So of these accounts, Berg breaks them down into the following three different categories. Number one, those that agree with Barlow's account, four entries. Those that agree with the anonymous account in Harley Manuscript 828, and the top page 9, those that do not give enough detail to be grouped with either. 9 accounts. So how many is that?
17.
So we need to change that to 17. After noting that a case could be made for including a letter by King James in the first category, Berg concludes his blog with the following statement regarding the veracity of Barlow's account. Quote, "We have now briefly noted each of the extant primary sources from which an examination of the Hampton Court Conference must be made. We have suggested that contrary to the once commonly asserted notions, Barlow's account is the most reliable source for reconstructing the conference, supplemented in important ways by other what? Sources. So in our next lesson then, we'll look at the men who participated in the meeting. So, any questions about any of this? Made through 9 pages. Mike didn't think we were going to. I was confident that we would make it. Any questions or comments? Will, you look like you.
No, I just find it kind of interesting that somebody who you would think would be advocating against that account has no arguments in marginal notes. You would think if there were any kind of disputations of what exactly occurred, that he would definitely have noted those. And I can see where the notes that he did put were more, you know, as it relates to the character or the nature of some of the individuals present.
So Chatterton's annotated copy of Barlow's work does not dispute any of the substantive notes on what happened at the meeting. All of the things that he does object to seem to be Barlow's characterization of the Puritans and personal stuff, not disputing the substance of what's recorded.
Would you think that, and maybe it should have been evident to me, but those would be things how James might have been acting towards the Puritans? Those would be the items that would have been disputed? Because perhaps, you know, on the backside of that conference, the Puritans would have rather had, you know, a more favorable representation of how James viewed them after that conference. So that, I mean, would you say that that's probably, those would be the things that you would expect to see disputed?
So I'm going to, if I can do it with relatively quickly, I want to open up the notes for next week, and I want to look at, I want to show you something that I think will speak to your question. And we're just going to have time, I'll just flash this on the screen, but we're not going to have time to get into all of it. So here's my notes for next week, and check out this. So this is a table of who's present at Hampton Court. Documented present. In other words, people that can be documented to have been there through sources. There's a lot of rumors about there were this many people or that many people, but there's no documentation to prove that. But check it out. So the royalty, you have James and his kid. That tells you something. Does James think he's about to do something that his kid needs to see? Okay? Is he gonna be giving him a lesson on how to be a king? Okay? Privy council members. So these would have been like political positions in the English government. Bishops. So these were Anglican bishops. Deans, these are also Anglican positions. Puritan speakers. 4. So here's my answer to your question. If those 4 guys were going to take exception to Barlow's account and say it was totally wrong, are there a chorus of other voices that would have said, no? You following me? So, and look who's saying, so where's Bartle's name? Bartle's right here. He's the guy who takes notes. A bunch of these guys end up on the translation committee, and there's only four Puritans present at the meeting. Is the debt stacked against these seditious Puritans? To use James's own words. It's totally stacked. Okay? So I would say, Will, that if, first of all, any objection to the, and there's Chatterton, by the way,
right on top.
So if anyone would have had a reason to say that Barlow was misrepresenting the substance of the meeting, that guy would have known, because he was there.
But what he did say in one of his notes was that the account is tolerably accurate. Tolerably is the key word.
Yeah, I mean, that's coming from his point of view, too.
Yeah.
But my point is, if these guys had came out with some sort of scathing review of Barlow's work and said how terribly inaccurate it was there a whole bunch of other people that could have chimed in on that and said and written about whether or not it was, in fact, as accurate as people wanted to say it was? So this table here, to me, is extremely instructive. Just as even visually, when you think about, whoa. So these four guys are in a room with all these other people in it that are on the opposite side. Not to mention, has the king already had a private meeting with the bishops 2 days before the meeting started? Did he call, when he called for the meeting, did his official proclamation call them seditious? So it's not hard to figure out what James doesn't like these guys. And the whole way he called for the meeting, structured the meeting, who's present at the meeting, says that he's not going to give these guys too much of what they want. And what's interesting, and I'm getting ahead because I can't help myself, he gives them the one thing that they asked for that was never in the millenary petition, and it was never on the agenda that they submitted to him before the meeting, and that's for a new what? So you have to ask yourself, why did he do that? Why would he do that? There has to be a reason for it, and I believe I know the reason. But you're going to have to come back to hear that. All right? So we have any last-minute questions or comments? I really hope you're not bored. I really hope you're still finding this interesting. In my opinion, we're just still kind of getting started on Lesson 154. I'm somewhat joking, but not really. So anyway, I'm going to shut this down. We're going to have to clean up. We'll be back here again next Sunday with Lesson 155, where we will look at some more things related to Hampton Court. Talk,